7 years ago, a South African lady was traveling through Heathrow Airport, and she had no idea that she was going to become globally famous or even infamous. She took her phone out, like everyone does in the airport, and she put a couple of messages onto Twitter. Probably people sat around her putting pictures of the plane or pictures of their coffee, or you know how it goes on Facebook and Twitter. She chose to make a couple of comments that were ill-advised, to say the least. In fact, she would say that she was just making a comment to reflect on how other people really don't understand the continent of Africa. That's what she would say. Everyone else would say, that's a racist comment and you shouldn't have tweeted it. Well, she tweeted it. And she got on the plane and took off, and 11 hours later, she discovered that she'd become globally famous. She had about 170 followers on Twitter, which isn't much. But her little tweet, her little comment had been retweeted, it had been copied and sent around tens of thousands of times. She'd already lost her job because of that. As she arrived at the airport in South Africa, there were people there to photograph her arriving because the whole world wanted to know if she was there yet. One ill-advised tweet, and everything was changed. That's kind of becoming a bit of a normal thing in our culture, isn't it? It's getting different labels, this online shaming. It gets called cancel culture. And basically, I looked up a definition. What is cancel culture? It's a collective, so it's groups of people together. It's a collective, deliberate shaming or attempt to undermine the income and reputation of a person or an organization who has done or even expressed something unhelpful or harmful. In fact, one of the people that retweeted her tweet and kind of helped to bring everything down on her, crashing down in her life, was interviewed about it afterwards. And he made a really interesting comment. He said, the only reason I was doing it was to get people to my website, to get people to my account. But he made this comment, and it was quite striking to me. He said, it's easy and thrilling to hate a stranger online. It's easy and thrilling to hate a stranger online. So simple. You just join in, sling mud, you know, go on the attack, and you're just part of a crowd, and people feel like they get to be part of something. It gets called online shaming. It gets called cancel culture. There's doxing, which is where people reveal somebody's private information to kind of make them fearful or afraid, to give them a difficult situation. Lots of different labels, lots of different angles. But it seems to be a unique part of our world today. Just think of the implications of it. One wrong action, past or present, one inappropriate comment, one misunderstood comment, and everything can come crashing down on you. Your relationships, your reputation, your finances, your future, everything devastated in an instant. Is this new? Well, in terms of social media, it certainly is. We wouldn't have imagined this 15 or 20 years ago. But actually, this kind of public shaming is not new at all, is it? I looked up our own culture, like go back a bit, the stocks, right? Stocks where somebody who commits a crime, I looked it up, one of them was not attending church on a Sunday, which made me chuckle, but all these crimes were punishable by being put in the stocks or the pillory. The pillory is that wooden board, you know, head and hands through it. And people walking past could throw things, you know, throw rotten fruit, spit in your face, maybe throw stones or more dangerous objects. The stocks is kind of the same thing, but for your feet, and you just kind of sit there. Now, thankfully, in this country, they were outlawed. 1837, the pillory, and 1872 was the last occasion the stocks were used, not too far from here. But actually, in the world today, there are places and cultures that are still using those things. Even for people breaking COVID guidelines, I've seen pictures of people put in the stocks in other countries. And you think, what's going on in our world? And then you remember, oh, that's right, we do it too. We just do it with social media. It's not new at all, is it? Public shaming for wrongdoing. And so if we travel back to the little town of Nazareth, maybe we can understand something of what was going on that first Christmas. We're looking at characters in the Christmas story. Last week we thought about Zechariah. Today we come to one of my absolute favorites. We're going to think about Joseph. Joseph, the stepdad of Jesus. And we're introduced to Joseph in Matthew's gospel. If you've got a Bible, please grab it or a device or whatever. And in Matthew chapter 1, we get this introduction to Joseph, and as soon as he's on the scene, I can't help but like this man. Let me tell you why. Now it says, the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph before they came together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. And her husband, Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. So they were betrothed. That means that they were committed to getting married. They weren't together yet. But in order to get out of a betrothal, there would have to be a divorce. And so the news came out that Mary was pregnant. And Joseph was understandably devastated. It's like the whole of his world just fell out, just like there was no floor left. He must have felt like he was falling, felt like he'd been punched in the stomach and he couldn't get his breath back. But it wasn't so much a physical winding as a sort of winding of his soul, of his heart, of his life, everything devastated by this news. And the most natural thing in the world, and the most natural thing in Nazareth would have been to put her to shame. Nazareth was a town of less than 500 people. That's like 1/100th of Chippenham. And we're hardly a metropolis, right? 100 Nazareths could fit in Chippenham. It's tiny, a tiny group of people where literally everyone would know everyone's business. The grapevine in Nazareth was probably as quick, if not quicker, than the grapevine online today. Not a global reach, but the whole world, as far as you know it, would know your business before you could snap your fingers. And the easiest thing in the world for Joseph would have been to say, I got to protect my reputation. And so I'm going to stand at the front. I'm going to be the one to throw the first stone. I'm going to be the one to sling the first bit of mud at her. I'm going to be really vehement that she's a sinner just to protect my own reputation. Maybe, just maybe, I can come out the other side of this with my reputation intact. But instead of doing that, he did not want to put Mary to shame. There's something very, very, what's the word? Something distasteful about covering somebody's sin when it's being tricky. But there's something incredibly beautiful about what Joseph is doing in this situation. He's protecting Mary, the sinner, from what she deserved. That's incredibly kind, isn't it? That meant that he would then have to live with question marks over what he had done, how he had been involved. You know, what's the story, Joe? But instead, he chose to protect her and take that for himself. Well, turns out that that's not really what was going on at all, because then, verse 20, we're told, as he considered these things, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary as your wife, for that which is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. When Joseph woke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took his wife, but knew her not until she had given birth to a son, and he called his name Jesus. We live in a culture, in a world, where you don't have to be a celebrity to be publicly shamed. It happens in school. It happens in universities. It happens in the workplace. It happens in neighborhoods. It can happen to anyone. And it's not always fair. And one of the things that is often a feature of public shaming is that those who you might expect to kind of mess up, they almost get a pass. But it's the good people that really get the rough ride. Nazareth was a town that was not known for anything particularly apart from sin. Little town, nothing to it, no reason to go there really. Just north of Nazareth was a place called Sepphoris, and in Sepphoris there was a garrison of soldiers. And so when the soldiers were off duty, they might head to Nazareth because nothing good comes from Nazareth, so maybe that's a good place to go for them. Nazareth was a place with a horrible reputation, and yet in the midst of this little town, there were at least two families that were trying to honor God, trying to live a good life. There was Joseph, the carpenter, and there was Mary's family. She was a teenage girl. And we're told by the passage that we read that there was a purity about Mary. And so when Mary, betrothed to Joseph, is found to be with child, that creates a massive tension for everybody in the community because this is the good couple, right? This is the ones that you'd expect to be better than the rest of us. But look at them. And the shame would have risen up. And the attack would be building. And the angel comes to Joseph and says, actually, there's an explanation. Not a soldier, not a neighbor, no one. It's the Holy Spirit that has conceived this child inside of Mary. Now that piece of information, that you don't get that every day, do you? In fact, you don't get that any day. That's the only day where that piece of information has ever been communicated, that a virgin is with a child and it is from God and it's God's plan. Like, this is a unique moment in human history. I want us to think for a few minutes about the tension that that news would have created for Joseph. Because you see, before we get to the news that he was given by the angel, we've got to think and use our imagination and recognize that leaves a whole load of unanswered questions, doesn't it? Okay, so the child is in her by the Holy Spirit, and okay. Now, I've got some questions. Like, for example, relationships. How's that going to work? What are my parents going to say? What are her parents going to say? What are our friends going to say? How am I supposed to relate to people with this going on? It's not going to go away. Like, this is going to be an issue, not just in relation. This is going to be an issue for my reputation for years to come. In fact, we know that it was an issue for the reputation of this family for literally decades to come. Because later on in John chapter 8, verse 41, we get to read one little line where Jesus is like in his 30s and he's having a conversation with these religious leaders and he's arguing with them about something and they don't like what he's saying and so they fire back at him. And you know what they say? At least we're not born of immorality. You see, the reputation stayed for years and Joseph had to face that. Relationships, reputation, finances. Like, in a town of less than 500 people as a carpenter, how do I get business if everybody's smirking and laughing and distrusting everything I say? How am I supposed to give a quote for some carpentry work and have them believe me when everybody's whispering behind my back? And poor Mary, how's she going to go to the market and get food with little Jesus kind of hanging on to her coattails? Like, everybody's going to be making comments. It's going to be impossible for us to be here. What kind of a future do we have? All of these questions. It's almost like he's living in 2020 facing social media shame. But he's having it the Nazareth version. Loads of questions. How, How are we supposed to live with this? Well, I'll tell you how they lived with it. The one thing I can tell you is based on this passage that they faced their public shame by pondering the angel's promise. That's all they had. They had that one moment in time where they could go back and think, yeah, but there was an angel that appeared to me and he appeared to you and he told us. And what did he tell us? Joseph knew three things about Jesus. He knew, number one, that he was from God. The Holy Spirit had conceived this child. This was no normal child. He knew that he'd come from God. He knew, secondly, that he was to be called Jesus. Why? For he shall save his people from their sins. Now, the name Jesus wasn't like a weird, like an uncommon name. It was super common. There were Jesuses all over the toddler groups of town, right? Jesus was not unusual at all. But the meaning of the name, Jesus, if you say it in Hebrew, it's Joshua. You say it in Aramaic, it's Yeshua. There are lots of different ways to say it. Doesn't matter. The name means the Lord saves. They knew that his name was deliberate. That the Lord saves. They also knew that in some way he was Emmanuel, God with us. Now, those are three truths, right? Three truths to cling on to. That God sent him in the first place, that he's sent on a mission to save his people from their sins, and in some way he is God with us. And in the weeks that became months, that became years, that became decades, Joseph lived knowing that that child was that set of truths. And he must have clung on to that. In fact, if you notice, there are three times in the passage where it makes a point of naming him. Verse 21, he's told, "You shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." Verse 23, "They shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us. That's a quote from the Old Testament, a prophecy predicting. That's not the name he used like a label. Jesus was the name he responded to, but they would have had Emmanuel in their minds as well. And then at the end of the passage, just to make sure we haven't missed it, verse 25, "And he called his name Jesus." Now just think about what that means practically over the coming years. If you've got children, how often do you use their name? Okay, now remove all the times you use their name because they're sinning, right? That's quite a lot, I know. But even so, there's still a lot of times where you use their name. Jesus, it's time for lunch. Jesus, can you help your dad in the workshop? Jesus, your brother just fell off the wall again. Can you help him? I've got my hands full. Hey, Jesus, would you mind? Your mother's needing somebody to go to the market with her. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Every time Mary and Joseph use the name Jesus, I wonder if inside they were just having a little flashback. He shall be called Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. This is Emmanuel, God with us. God gave us this child in a unique and a special way. And for the next 10, 20, however many years Joseph lived, he lived with the tension of the public shame, but the promise that the angel had given him. We don't know how long Joseph lived, but we do know a little bit about him. And I just want you to notice one more detail in this passage. Right at the end, where it says, verse 24, "Joseph woke from sleep. He did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took his wife and knew her not until she had given birth to a son." Joseph had a dream. The angel spoke to him. Joseph immediately obeyed. And Matthew wants us to notice that, just like he wants us to notice the three things about Jesus, just like he wants us to see that three times the passage underlines the fact that he's named and his name matters. Three times Joseph, at least, has a dream and then immediately obeys. If we go over to chapter 2, we get the story of the wise men arriving. They come to Jerusalem, meet King Herod, come find the baby, and all of that scene, that happens. They leave. Then what happens? Joseph has another dream. Chapter 2, verse 13. "Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. Now that's quite impressive obedience, isn't it? Imagine getting a dream, right? Angel appears and he says, right, quick, move to Belgium. All right. Like instantly got up and moved to Egypt. It happens again. After that, we get the account of Herod doing what Herod's famous for. And then you come down to verse 19. When Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. Joseph's plan was to go back to Bethlehem. I'm almost certain of it. Why would he want to go to Nazareth? Nazareth was like, you know, shame central for the family. It's going to be just too awkward. Bethlehem, on the other hand, makes a lot of sense. He would have had family there, connections. They were probably there for quite a number of weeks. Christmas didn't all happen overnight. So there's a bit of history there. And so I would imagine Joseph was planning to head back to Bethlehem. Hey, there's plenty of, you know, buildings there too. I can be a carpenter in Bethlehem. Makes sense. Perhaps an easier option. Verse 22, but when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. The history books tell us that Archelaus was even more of a nutter than Herod was. So, being warned in a dream, there's another one. He withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and he lived in a city called Nazareth. And so the story goes full circle. And Joseph ends up led by God back to the one place that would be incredibly difficult to live in. The one place where everybody thought they knew the truth. Where everybody still cracked jokes at his expense. Where everybody wondered what was the true story. And the days became weeks, and the weeks became months, and the months became years. And all the way through that time, Joseph continued to be, I believe, a good man, a good stepfather, a good husband to Mary, a good dad to the others. He was a good and a godly man who, in the midst of the public shaming and ridicule, clung on to the promise that the angel had given him. God gave this child Jesus. God sent this child to rescue his people from their sins. And in this child, in a special way, God is with us. I think Joseph's a bit of a hero, don't you? Someone who was always ready to do the right thing as soon as he was told. Always ready to look out for the safety of his family. Ready to lead and protect and work and do all the things necessary so that his family could thrive in the midst of an incredibly hostile environment. We don't know what happened to Joseph. We don't know when he died, but we presume he does. Sometime between Jesus age 12, where we get a little glimpse, and Jesus age 30, where Joseph gets no mention at all, the assumption is he must have passed away. Maybe still wondering, how is it that this boy, given by God, is going to rescue his people from sin? How is it that this boy is God with us? What is going on? If we read on through Matthew, we come to the end of the gospel, and we discover that whatever Joseph may have imagined, he was probably wrong. Maybe he thought Jesus is going to grow up and he's going to be powerful enough so that when Mary goes to the marketplace, he can shut the mouths of the people who make the comments and make her cry. Or maybe he thought, maybe this Jesus is going to grow up to be bigger than that. Maybe he's going to be like a national leader that can throw off the Romans and get rid of the enemies and protect us and deliver us from evil in that way. But I bet he never imagined what actually happened. At the other end of Matthew's gospel, we go from the first Christmas to the first Easter, and we see Jesus hanging naked, shamed, humiliated on a cross. Not just having his head and hands in a stocks, you know, in a pillory, not just being humiliated for a few hours, but literally being humiliated to death. The one person who didn't deserve it rescued his people from sin by suffering the greatest humiliation possible. Matthew tells us there were women in the crowd. John tells us that Mary was stood right there, looking at her son suffering and dying. Why? Because that's Jesus, the one that God sent into this world to rescue us from our own sin by taking the punishment that we deserve, by taking the humiliation that actually is well deserved by us humans. He took it on himself and he died in our place because he was Emmanuel, God with us. Joseph didn't know that when he died, but Mary did. And we do because Matthew's gospel makes sure that we get it. Whatever we face, no matter how tough our world becomes, no matter how antagonistic the 2020s are for us, no matter how much public humiliation and shame is heaped on us for positions that we take or views that we express, whatever we face, God doesn't promise to deliver us from it, as in rescue us and put us somewhere secret where nobody knows. In fact, he might have us stay right in the midst of the great challenge of representing him in a world that hates everything that he stands for. But here's the promise that holds us and can hold us through a much more difficult decade than maybe we've ever faced before. Jesus. Jesus came into this world because it was God's plan. His plan was to come into this world to pay the penalty and to rescue us from our sin. And in Jesus, we have God with us. That's the message of Christmas. That's the message that I think if Joseph was able to kind of shout down from heaven, he would say, "Don't think about me, think more about Jesus." Because that's what the angel told him. That's what this passage tells us. And that's what we, I believe, need to cling on to as we go past this Christmas and into this next year.